Welcome to the Noncompliant Podcast. I'm your host, Anne Borden King. Noncompliant is on a bit of a hiatus, but I've hopped out of hiatus to do one show today. Today I'm speaking with Lee Wiley Midsky. Lee is a writer and artist, creator of the Neurodivergent Narwhals, co-director of NeurodiversityLibrary.org, and founder of the Neurodiversity Library Movement. They are the community outreach coordinator at the Autistic Women and Non-Binary Network and a contributor to the group's anthology, Sincerely, Your Autistic Child. Lee has presented at a range of conferences and gatherings on autistic advocacy and neurodiversity libraries in the community. You can find Lee's work on their library website, which is neurodiversitylibrary.org, and on other links that we'll include on the podcast blog. Lee is the co-owner of Stanwood Tattoo Company in Stanwood, Washington, which also hosts a neurodiversity library. We're going to talk today about their library initiatives, the Narwhals, Autistic Community, and more. Lee, welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you. Thank you for having me.
Thanks. How did you first get involved in autistic advocacy?
So right around the time that I'm a parent and my child is autistic, and they were actually diagnosed before I was. And during the process of having them get a professional diagnosis, it was mentioned to me that I might also want to seek out a diagnosis. So I did. And actually, it was the recommendation of a counselor at my child's school that I check out blogs by autistic people. And I did that. And one of the first ones I read was Radical Neurodivergent Speaking. And that really got me interested in advocacy and activism. And I just started making connections in the community and reading a lot of blogs by autistic people and learning a lot for a few years before I became involved myself.
Wow. And then let's talk about the Narwhal Project, because that was one of your early projects. It's still ongoing. The Narwhals are these amazing graphics that educate about autism and promote understanding. They're on social media, and there's also a series of free downloadable books and posters. They're for kids and adults and parents, and they're so artistic and wonderful and accessible and eloquent. I'm going to list out just a few of the titles of the Narwhal books. One is Why Is Everything So Weird? A COVID Social Story. Everyone Communicates, which is about AAC. Inclusion in the Classroom, The Language of Neurodiversity, Whole Body Understanding. And these are just some of the titles that are available on neurodiversitylibrary.org. But my first question, I think, is why did you choose the narwhal for your books?
So the narwhal, I just really like narwhals. And mm-hmm. and I thought that neurodivergent narwhals sounded really nice together. So that's pretty much the reason I chose narwhals. Plus, they're really cute and I like them a lot. And they're interesting and they're different. Like when I first started making the graphics and the little comics, people actually thought I made up the creature, and I know it's a real thing. There are actually narwhals that exist. They don't look like little like happy balloon animals. but yeah, so I wanted to find a way that was kind of fun and to take concepts like the neurodiversity paradigm that were like really inaccessible to a lot of people and make them more accessible and fun and kind of easy to understand. And I just thought the narwhals fit with that.
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the amazing things about the books is that there are all these concepts and they're talked about in academia and research and things like that. But so much of the discussion until really recent times through work like yours has been very inaccessible and also just not enjoyable, you know, to read about and understand. And neurodiversity is a wonderful, enjoyable thing. And these books really, really reflect that as well. What has been the community response to the Narwhal Project?
People seem to really like them. And sometimes I'll have people share them with me, not realizing that I'm the creator of them, like asking me to like what I think of it. And it's been really positive. I've actually like sold some like curriculum materials to different school districts in the United States and Canada. Some therapists and therapy practices have purchased them. And even there was a television show that reached out to me and wanted to buy some posters for set design for a bedroom of a character who was autistic. And I'm still working on a book that I hope to self-publish. And it's a little bit hard because it's just me, but hopefully I'll be able to finish it soon. But I think that the response has been pretty positive.
Wow, that's amazing. What about the schools? Were they using that to educate students or?
I think they were using it for students and for teachers, and just as classroom posters.
Wow. And so it's taking off. It's still going. It's amazing. You also founded the Neurodiversity Library Project. What is a neurodiversity library?
So, a neurodiversity library is just like a curated collection of books, information, and resources that reflect the values of the neurodiversity paradigm, autism acceptance, and disability justice. And they can look very different, like one from the other, because a big goal of mine with the project is to make it accessible, not just for people to get the information, but for the people who are running it to make it work in the way that works best for them. So, some of them, like my library, is an actual little bookmobile that's in my tattoo shop. But there are some people who just collect funds and they donate books to their local library. And some people have little free libraries. And there's other people who just bring books to play groups. And so it can look, one could look very different from another one.
That's so cool. What was your inspiration to do the project?
So a big inspiration was just the lack of available resources in my community. There were resources about autism, but none of them were from actually autistic people or other disabled people. And what was available was not like neurodiversity or disability justice informed. And I knew that there were resources out there, but people just weren't getting them unless you were looking for them specifically. And a big inspiration for me was also my father, who I strongly suspect was autistic, and he was definitely neurodivergent, and he had some physical disabilities, and he was a grassroots community activist. He worked a lot with people in poverty and doing food distribution programs and free meals in our community. And he was extremely passionate about justice and using what he had to help other people. And my family was, we were always talking about social issues. And my dad taught me things about feminism and socialism and racial justice. And I know he didn't have an easy life, but he absolutely believed that part of why he was here was to make the world a better place than it was before. So I feel like the library is kind of honoring my dad's legacy.
Wow, is that, did you name the library after him?
Yes, I did.
Yeah, the Ed Wiley.
Autism Acceptance Library.
Yeah. So, how did the project, you started your library, and then how did it spread and grow beyond that?
So when I started the library, I really didn't realize that it would grow, but a few weeks after I kind of created mine, I got an email from Lana Thomas, and we did not each know each other at the time, but we actually have become like really close friends. And she wanted to start a library of her own in California, where she lived at the time. So we just exchanged emails, and I tried to answer any questions that she had. And once she created her library, we worked together to create a resource for other people who might be interested in creating their own. So we made a PowerPoint on how to do it, and we went to conferences and presented it. And we created a Facebook group to connect people who are interested in starting neurodiversity libraries. It
Wow, and when was all this happening or starting up?
was about 2014.
So, who uses your library or the neurodiversity libraries in general?
A lot of autistic people use the library, especially newly diagnosed people who are looking for information. And just wanting to not feel alone. Parents, teachers, professionals, they all come to the library, or anyone who's interested in learning more, especially since I have it in my shop now. A lot of people who wouldn't otherwise check it out just see it and they want to like find information and they really enjoy it.
Wow, what kind of feedback do you get from parents?
It depends. It kind of, a lot of the information that I present is very different from what they've been told. So if they're open to learning from autistic people, I've had very positive feedback. But if they're more just resistant to the ideas of neurodiversity and disability justice, then I kind of get a little bit more pushback.
Yeah. What about, I mean, from autistic people, it must just be such a just a generally positive response.
Yeah, I think it is. And I've ended up meeting people who, especially since it's been in my shop, people come and, they don't expect it to be here. And they'll tell me that they're autistic or even that their child is autistic. But I've had more than one person like tell me that they're autistic after seeing the library and reading some of the information and just making these connections and even having like email relationships with some people. who want to like find out more. And I always welcome people, especially on our slow days, to just come to the library and hang out. And that usually is a pretty fun time.
Yeah. I mean, it must feel like a safe space, especially for people who might have stress in other parts of their life or be facing ableism in other parts of their life, to just be in a place that's so affirming.
Mm-hmm. That's what I hope. And I hope that that continues too.
It seems like the libraries are an opportunity not just to lend out books, but, and I should say, we're starting one here, so I'm like really looking into this a lot, but it's more than just lending books. It seems like it's about building community and helping people in their lives. Is that something that you see happening in the libraries?
I do see that. And I know from my own experience, I work very closely with our local community resource center. They do a lot of outreach too, and we kind of collaborate. We do monthly events called community conversations, and we talk about autism and disability, but sometimes we'll have guests talking about like equity and diversity. And they're all people who are local in my community, and just like kind of giving them a platform and having these conversations that I think are really important to our community, especially where I live. It's a very small town, and some of the ideas are not as welcome here, but I see that it's rapidly changing, and I love that. And I also collaborate on Autism Acceptance Month events with our resource center and also with AWN, the Autistic Women and Nonbinary Network. And they actually do a lot of, they are the primary funders of the library as well. And one thing that we're doing that I'm really excited about is where I live, Stanwood, Washington, is having its first ever Pride event in June. And my library has a tent there, and it's just going to be a sensory break station for anyone who wants to go to Pride, but it might be a little overwhelming. So they can come and sit in our tent and read some books and play with some STEM toys and just relax for a little bit away from the noise.
Wow, that's great. And, you know, there's so much overlap in the queer community and the autistic community that there will just be tons of people who will need something like that. Can you give some examples of how people are creating their libraries to fit their communities, like to fit the needs of their communities that, and how their communities look?
Yeah, there's, so one of the libraries was called LA Neurodiversity, and you know, Los Angeles is a huge city. So what they did was raise money, and they donated books to their local library because they felt that that would have the most impact and also be the most accessible for them. And I know there's a one in Northern Virginia, and that is run by a parent who's also really involved in like talking about gentle parenting and peaceful parenting of autistic children. And so what they do is they bring books to play groups and parks, and they just meet with parents and loan out their books. And there's so many ways to do it. I know that in Australia, there's Neurodiversity Hub, which has just grown beyond a library. And now they're doing a lot of like classes and just meetings and like support groups for people who are autistic or LGBTQ. So there's really so many ways to do it.
Yeah. I mean, it's changed over time too, I would guess. Like probably some libraries are starting to have some of a collection, or at least be more open to having a collection. Like I'm thinking public libraries. Do people relate with their public libraries a lot around this, or does it tend to be sort of independent of the library?
Yeah, I believe that Paper Boat Autism Library, and that's in Mississippi, mm-hmm. I believe that they actually had experience working in a library, and that's kind of what inspired them to do the Neurodiversity Library. And I know that I actually went to a conference a few years ago that was a librarian conference, and it was called Targeting Autism. And they wanted to learn how to bring materials into the library that were more inclusive. So I went there and I met a lot of librarians there who were like official librarians uh-huh. who were really excited. And they've actually some of them have emailed me, or some of them have joined our neurodiversity group, and they want to find ways to bring books into their library that like kind of celebrate autistic people.
Yeah. And that's such a change. That's such a change from, you can easily walk into a library even today, especially a couple years ago, and of course online. And before initiatives like yours, like even just a few years ago, you could just be searching for information about autism and and the first things that would pop up in on the bookshelves at the library or online are just these terrible, terrible stories that don't reflect real life.
Yeah. And when I started the library, I actually did go to my local public library and looked for the books on autism they had. And they had Thinking in Pictures by Temple Grandin. And then they had some books by professionals, but they had books by parents. And one of the books that they had was called I Would Rather Be Engulfed in Flames. And it was a parent writing about parenting her autistic child. And so that was a big inspiration to start the library, too.
Since you started the libraries, what's changed in how people respond to it, or just generally within the world of the parents and families?
When I started the library, I feel like I was criticized a lot for pushing back on things like ABA and organizations like Autism Speaks. And in the last few years, I'm seeing more and more people coming to me and already like recognizing the things that are problematic about them. And I'm seeing more parents who are willing to listen to autistic adults than before, and even listening to autistic adults who they might not have the easiest time listening to, which is most important, I think.
What do you think needs to happen to really bring people from the margin to the center that are continually marginalized within also our own activists and advocacy spaces?
I would say to learn about disability justice and to really learn about that before you start a library, because it's really important to be informed about what that actually means. And to also not be afraid to like pass the mic, because you don't always need to be the person centered. Mm-hmm. And one of the things I'm trying to do when I have the community conversation events with my community resource center is to make sure that when I have the events that they are platforming people who usually don't get a platform in my community.
Let's say someone wants to start a neurodiversity library from scratch in their community. What are some of the first steps to start to build one?
So, like I said, I think learning is a big step, and also finding out what the needs are in your community and to make sure that you don't like overextend yourself and it's something that you can do and know that you might need to take breaks and it might not happen as fast as you want it to. It took me a long time to get to a place where I was really comfortable and I felt like I had the routine for doing my library events and having an in-person library. But I really think the big thing was making the connections in my community also, and not just in my local community, which is extremely important, but also with the autistic community. Like, I collaborate a lot with AWN Network. I've had some collaborations with like ASAN in the past where they've donated books to me, and just like finding the people who can help you.
Yeah. It sounds like, how would someone overextend themselves by just like trying to do too much too fast, or?
Yes. And I've done that in the past where I tried to do too much too fast. So now I take summers off. But I tried to do so much of everything by myself, and it was really not like sustainable. So I slowed down a lot. Like in the past, I would bring my entire library in totes to my community resource center, which was really fun and I liked it a lot. But it just got to be like more of a job, because I had to carry the books back and forth. And then I had to do a lot of advertising, like, please come and see me.
Right.
And it was a lot of work, and it was worth it. But then when we opened our tattoo shop, I said, I can have it here while I'm already here working. And it's still a space for people in the community can come in and check it out. And it's not quite as much work for me. And I can still maintain my relationship with our resource center locally and do special events once a month or when I'm able to. So, yeah.
Yeah. I don't know if it's an autistic thing or what it is, that this kind of idea, I have it a lot. It's always a terrible idea, but I continue to have it and I fight that. Mm-hmm. That, well, I'll just do it myself.
Mm-hmm. Like, yeah.
Why am I saying this? I'll just do it myself. You know, there's so many things wrong with that way of, you know, doing. I don't know if it maybe comes from parenting experience too or something, but I was at a meeting of a disability coalition. It's a Ontario, a bunch of different disability related groups in Ontario. And we have these meetings every month or so. And we got to talking about some really just terribly grim legislation that they're talking about in Canada around assisted dying. And it's very problematic. And we were all talking about how to get the message out about how troubling it is. And a lot of the work in this space is often about trying to inform people about things that are really going wrong. And then somebody said, well, what are we going to do to help people in our community? We're talking about how we want to, you know, get the message out to the broader community that this is bad. But how are we going to help people in our community not just become totally despairing about this and bring people joy and have people feel hope, right? I think I, like you, I grew up adjacent to activism, like always, like, and sort of came of age with like a megaphone in my hand, you know, and rallies, and this is what we do on Friday night, right? And in that time, at least where I lived in Madison, Wisconsin, it was pretty much like, you just do everything you can do to save the world until you can't do anything anymore. And then you just burn out and then you disappear and nobody sees you again for a really long time. And maybe you bought a house in the country or something. And there was no sense of like self-care or anything like that. It was pressure, pressure, pressure. Are you going to be there? Are you going to do it? And the thing is that the problems that we're dealing with in the world are so big, fixing them is like a multi-generational process. And so, and now I'm trying to just take a breath and say, like, I'm going to do what I can do, but this is like a really long, you know, struggle, yeah. Right? And part 50%, you know, as an activist maybe is helping people be okay, helping the people doing the work be okay.
Yes. Yeah, that's why I was never like, I guess like a group project type of person, but but I have learned over the years that that's really like what I need and what everybody needs, because you need people to do like the type of activism that's like bigger picture, you know, and even like policy work. And then you need people to like take care of people locally. You need all of it. And some people, their strength is policy work. Mine is not. My strength is more like local community, like very grassroots. And I also think that finding community is good, because some people will give you ideas that you never thought of before, or you might give people ideas that they never thought of before. And I don't know, it's surprising to me, being such a shy, quiet person and very like independent, like I'll do it myself, to like find my community and know that I need them and they need me too. So.
Right. So we talked a little bit about how someone starts a library, which is to have the idea, connect with people in the community and not bite off more than you can chew. There's also a Facebook group for neurodiversity librarians. Is that right?
Yes, there is. And I'm not the best Facebook group moderator, I'll say that now. But I'm trying to be more active. And it's one of the reasons that I started doing Zoom meetings with neurodiversity librarians. They're a little more accessible for me. Facebook groups, you can get kind of bogged down in the comments, and it's just a little bit confusing sometimes for me. So, but there is a group, and it is very helpful. And we like give each other advice and talk about different books and different projects that people are doing. So, yes.
Yeah, it's an amazing group. I attended my first Zoom a while ago, and what I thought was really great was also the way it's building connections across different communities really around the world, so we can find each other too as part of something broader.
Yeah, and that's why I like doing the meetings. One of my favorite parts of like activism is just finding connections with people. And I feel like it's really important, especially if you're someone like me. I live in a very rural area and it's a little isolated. And sometimes it feels like you're the only one who knows anything about neurodiversity or disability justice, and it can be pretty isolating. So it's nice to connect with other people who are doing the same kind of work to try to educate their communities too.
Yeah, it's really, really positive. And I was wondering about the future and, well, let's say 2022, 2023. What does that look like for you in terms of the libraries and the narwhals and everything else that you're doing?
So I hope to finish my book. It's been a long process and I'm teaching myself along the way. So I hope to finish it this year. We'll see if that happens. I hope to have more meetings on Zoom with neurodiversity librarians so we can collaborate with each other and learn from each other. I know one thing that's coming up is the Pride event in Stanwood that I'm so excited about, to be able to meet people in my community at an event that's just a celebration. So I feel like that is a really positive impact that my library will have. And I want to continue my community conversations where we bring people to the library and to the community to talk about important topics. And I will continue working together with AWN as well. And I'm really excited about some of the projects I'm working on with them also. We're just exploring a couple options to kind of bring our liberating webinars into other avenues. And just working, a thing that I want to do is working with different autistic bloggers like Marenike Giwa and I did a series of webinars with Jules from Autistic Typing. Mm-hmm. And I finished one several months ago with Aisha Ray, who does Raising Luminaries, and hopefully that will be edited and put out soon. And it's about ableism and using children's literature to fight back against ableism.
Well, we're going to include links to Lee's projects and other projects related to the Neurodiversity Library Project. And I just want to say thanks again, Lee, for being on the podcast. It was really, really interesting. Thank you.
Thank you so much for having me.
We were speaking with Lee Wiley-Mitsky. They spoke to us from Stanwood, Washington. You've been listening to Noncompliant, the podcast. I'm your host, Anne Borden-King. Noncompliant is recorded at MCS Studios in Toronto. This episode was engineered by Francois Heroux and transcribed by Julianne Lee. Thanks to Francois, who is his last engineering, and thank you for so many great episodes. And thanks also to Julianne Lee for the amazing transcription and to everyone involved and everyone for listening.